Good afternoon, and welcome to Dialect Radio for the week beginning 10th of July. This week has a bit of a North Somerset feel as we hear from Julian Parry, who is pioneering his own new system for waste management. He believes it will reduce the energy used and damage done by the waste industry in our region, and possibly beyond. Also, Tony Giles from Weston. He's a blind man, but that hasn't stopped him travelling all over the world on a shoestring all on his own, and he's put many of his unique experiences in an online book. In the studio, we also have an infamous Bristol whistler by the name of Don Townsend. Carried over from last week, one of Britain's greatest living film directors, Ken Loach, was in Bristol recently, and he spoke in withering terms about the BBC's coverage of the Gaza aid flotilla story. He says the future of the region depends on objective reporting. We have some singing for you as well. Chanda from last week's episode, a Zimbabwean band. He's in a Zimbabwean band called Chimanimani. And Jess Sparks will also be along to tell us more about what's going on in the world this week. Well, we start this week with Julian Parry. Hello.
Well, hello to you.
You've come in absolutely splendid attire, with an excellent tie. I'm really pleased you've made such a lot of effort. We do get some very scruffy people in here.
Well, we are on radio.
Oh, absolutely. So tell me a little bit about yourself. You're a retired engineer, stroke building surveyor. What exactly have you been doing?
Well, I'm a building surveyor, and I spend a lot of time in Bristol, in Southmead Hospital, and then the Bristol Royal Infirmary Group, and then Bristol University, where I even used to look after the University Tower. And it was a very interesting job. Everything from foundations to chimney pots, pigsties to nuclear laboratories.
Right, okay. And when did you first take some interest in waste management as an issue? That's not something that necessarily springs to a lot of people's minds as a...
It came about in 1980 when I was in private practice and I was a litigating building surveyor. Mm. And I was instructed by a local solicitor to look at a job in Road, Wiltshire, where I was told a small barrel of oil had gone into somebody's garden. When I got there, the barrel was 4 metres long, 2 metres diameter, and we were talking about 9,000 litres had gone into a wonderful garden from a 17th century listed building, and there were 6 tree preservation orders on it and a stream. The complications were immense, but we did manage to clean up the garden using new technology which uses microbes to clean the oil away from the land without digging it out.
Okay, so it's probably similar kind of stuff they're using over in the States at the moment with their vastly huge oil spill, I would imagine.
I don't think they're using in situ airblown remediation at this time. No, I don't think they're doing that.
That's an excellent bit of jargon there. Biological remediation systems I've got down as here as your particular point of interest. So how does this work in terms of sort of household waste? What does it mean?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that the microbes that live in oxygen, the aerobes, can take something like oil and reduce it to carbon dioxide and water. That's the fundamental principle.
Right.
Now, when we get into the waste business, we have found that if we treat waste in a certain way till we get the organic, it's a bit difficult to describe to listeners who haven't got a scientific background, but the organic material is all the wood fibre, cloth, stuff like that, cotton, anything that's grown, let's put it loosely like that. Mm-hmm. Once you get that fibre into a big silo, we have found that we can dry it using microbes rather than heat energy.
Right.
And of course, we put a little energy in, but we have to get a lot of energy out, and then we get a very dry material come out of it, which can then be used as a fuel. And that means that we can remove all the biodegradable waste that the government is worried about and doesn't want going into landfill. We can take that out of the waste stream completely, use it as a fuel, and with new generating techniques which are coming online now, produce enough electricity to serve up to 30% of the household's contributing waste.
Okay, so very commercially viable.
Immensely commercially viable. It's so viable, in fact, that if councils were to build their own plants on their own land, they could possibly reduce council tax by 20%.
Okay, well, that's interesting because you mentioned local councils there. A lot of people's public perception of Bristol City Council is not always particularly positive. Have you tried interacting with them and about this? How have they taken this idea?
I've tried a little with Bristol Council, but I was much more interested in trying to get it going in North Somerset, where the words rebuffed and rebuked were really the watchwords of the day. I think they're a little upset that a few years ago it was me that did the mathematics that proved there had been a massive waste fraud that affected North Somerset Council particularly, and I produced a mathematical method of identifying who had committed the fraud, when it was committed, and how much had been committed.
Okay, so
I was not very popular for that.
Right. What do you mean by fraud? How do you commit fraud in terms of waste?
You commit fraud in terms of waste by preloading lorries with brickbats or with water in tanks, and you have 9 tons of waste on board and maybe a couple of tons of, what shall we call it, ballast. You'd go in over the weighbridge at the transfer station, you weigh in the full amount, you go in and you only push, say, 9 tons off and drive out with another 2 tons. But of course, nobody notices because you only go in to have your tare, spelled T-A-R-E, that's the net curbside weight of a lorry, measured once a month. And the computer remembers that, doesn't it? So obviously, when you go in by appointment to have your lorry reweighed, you go in with very little fuel in the tank and certainly no ballast. And that's how you set it up.
Okay, and what would be the purpose of doing this in terms of the council? What would it?
Defrauding the council of huge amounts of money. And I think somewhere between £7 and £10 million was ripped off over the years 1996 to 2006.
Okay, and the council were not pleased that you'd uncovered this, per se. Is that?
There were certain persons in the council
who
were...
I mean, you saved the money, presumably, if you stopped the council being defrauded.
Well, no, we could have saved the taxpayers' money, but there are certain people who are on council, or should I say have been there a long time, who have a different agenda.
What is that agenda? You put a nicely oblique sort of phrase.
Well, their agenda is to obtain, I believe, some sort of benefit, although I have to say that the fraud squad who were involved, along with Customs and Revenue and Customs, and with the Audit Commission, couldn't find the brown paper envelopes. But at the same time, they did admit, this was a senior fraud squad officer admitted, that if it had been going on abroad, then they wouldn't have been able to find it. Or if there had been promises of benefits after people left office or after contracts were completed, and there's some evidence of that, then obviously they wouldn't find that either.
Right, okay.
What is interesting is that whilst people have tried to poo-poo it and say that I'm off my trolley, even one council leader said, what has not been done by any of them is to say that the fraud did not happen.
Okay. I mean, do you have to approach local councils? I mean, presumably if you're providing to the electricity grid, what about private companies and private interests that might be interested in this?
These plants are really quite expensive to build. They would cost somewhere in the region of £65 million, which would be about £350 per head of population, and that would be enough to cover 200,000 people. Mm-hmm. Of course, that would compare quite well with the incinerator that was going to go into Avonmouth, which was going to cost £160 million, so it's cheaper than that. Fortunately, we would also have a power station putting out about 15 megawatts included in that scheme. But these people are not keen to go down those roads and take up new technology, and it's very difficult to get past people, especially when there are other interests, vested interests at play, and they really don't want to talk to you.
Okay, and have you thought about approaching any other councils, or are you purely trying to...
Now, what we decided to do, which we've done this last couple of weeks, is we've made a film, which is about 12 and a half minutes long. And it's been professionally made by a producer who has done a lot of work for the BBC. So it's of the most excellent quality. And that is now available on YouTube and Facebook under JT Protocol, if you put that into the search field. JT Protocol, lowercase, all one word, and up will come the film, and you can see exactly how the system works.
Okay,
in broad terms.
Because I was just going to ask if you could explain how your system works in a nutshell.
Well, here we go. Here comes the science, and my apologies. The first thing you do is you put the waste in one bag in the home. You do not have to segregate. So all those wheelie bins, the red one, the brown one, the green one, the black one, and then the recycling bin, and then the food waste slop bucket, which Caroline Spelman, the minister, was a new minister for waste, was mentioning the other day. You don't have any of those. You use a special type of plastic bag, which has the wonderful capacity to vanish at 60 degrees centigrade. They will last for ages on the pavement, as long as you keep them in the shade and don't let the rainwater get hot on them, in which case you'll get holes through them. But otherwise, you keep them cool and they will last for months. I've done it, and I know that this is a fact. These bags are then put into what is known as an autoclave. Mm-hmm. Now, this is where we're going to get a little bit tricky. Imagine a huge cement mixer, 13 metres long, 4 metres diameter, with huge spirals inside it, cap on the top, cap on the bottom, and it rotates. The waste is put in with high-speed conveyors that throw it down to the back of the machine and through a 5-foot opening. And the next thing you know is it gets off turning, and then all the air is pumped out or down to a very low pressure.
Mm-hmm.
The machine is very thick and will withstand the pressure.
Okay.
Once the pressure is down, of course, any unwrapped packages, even the very fibres of the material itself, burst open. Now you put in steam at high pressure and high temperature, and I'm afraid those are trade secrets, and the thing is rotated for something like 2.25 hours.
Right.
So the next thing, after the material is discharged, it is drained and put across what we call a star screen. The star screen sorts out the tin cans and the big pieces of glass and plastic from all the organic material, which we term a flock. Mm-hmm. The flock drops through. We have some magnetic separation techniques in there to make sure we don't get nails and small bits and pieces going through. And basically, we can sort out the aluminium cans, the steel cans, the glass, and the organic material to separate them. The organic material then goes into my SBS system, stands for soils biostimulation.
Okay.
There it is dried in about 3 weeks, and then it becomes a fuel, and it goes straight into the furnaces of the Sukse generation system, which is brand new and straight out of South Africa, and we can produce enormous amounts of electricity. So we have complete recycling, plenty of energy, and the recyclates that come out of the system are, of course, sterile, fully washed. There are no labels, no paint, and very high quality, ready for resale. And let's not forget, aluminium, and there's a lot of it, is worth £2,000 a tonne.
£2,000 a tonne. Well, if people want to find out more, you've got your video on YouTube, which explains it, JT Protocol. Are there any other places on the web they can go if they're interested in finding out more about your system?
We've got it on Facebook, and we've also got jtprotocol.com.
Mm-hmm.
If they like to link in there, I believe some material has just been put up on there as well.
Brilliant. Julian Parry, thank you very much for coming and explaining that.
Thank you. We'll be right back.
Well, it's my pleasure to introduce to the studio a man who's described himself as being very modest. In fact, he said it was one of his faults. But luckily for Britain, he was not so modest that he did not appear on Britain's Got Talent. So, Don Townsend, hello.
Oh, hello there.
So, you're a local Bristol lad. Whereabouts do you live?
Yeah, I live in a place called Withywood in Bristol. Mm-hmm. You know, been living there now for, I don't know, since I was married. I mean, that's that'll be 40 years on the 25th of this month.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you very much. And we've only had one argument, you know.
Really?
Yeah, it's lasted all the time.
Now, famously, your appearance was whistling on Britain's Got Talent, and you've produced, you have a whole bag full of CDs and all sorts of things with you.
Yes.
Of Don the Whistler, that's what you call yourself, and you appeared with your wife Thelma.
That's right.
So how long ago did you realise you had a talent for whistling?
Yeah, it all started at the age of six. What it was, my parents were very keen on music and musical, and what they did, they took me not far from here over to the Hippodrome, mm-hmm. right? And over there was appearing a man called Ronnie Renaud, and Ronnie Renaud is basically the world's ever greatest whistler.
Okay.
Yeah, fantastic, he is, do anything, right? He's still whistling now, and he's 87. It was his birthday, funny enough, Sunday before last. Mm-hmm. He lives now in the Gold Coast. He's from originally he was from Islington in London.
Yeah,
and basically I heard him and I thought I'm not really clever, see. So I was watching him in the Hippodrome. So I thought, when I get home, I lived in I lived in Edley Park then, mm-hmm. and so when I got home, I thought I'm going to try to start whistling if I can. I'm going to try to do it. I can't do anything else. I'm not really clever, so I started to do it, see, and the old neighbours and all that, they weren't too happy about it. One or two wanted to move out and
it could be worse.
Be upset a few.
Play the drums or the trombone? Or...
Yeah, exactly. I could have gone for something else, but I went for whistling, see, so I did upset rather the street and what have you, see. But I kept on going, and gradually, I sort of got better at it. Now, Ronnie Rennell's favourite, well, he had a big hit with it, you see, in the 40s. It's called In a Monastery Garden. Mm-hmm. And what you do with this particular one is that it's like birdsong, mm-hmm. you see. And I have been known when I'm out doing this that it actually makes people cry. And I have said to them, it's not as bad as that, is it? You see, and you know, it's a big hit as whistlers go.
I mean, to some people, Percy Edwards would probably be a more famous name. So what?
Not
did
really.
He
no. He was a different sort of whistler. You see, he concentrated on the birds and the animals. Mm-hmm. Marvelous man, mind you. I mean, fantastic. But I couldn't do that really. But what I really do is I'm not so much doing the bird songs, but actually, you know, copying the music.
Okay, so what are your favourite kinds of music? What artists or sort of tunes do you like to perform?
Well, the point is, you see, we go around old people's homes and clubs, and the thing is, where we go, the older people like the old songs. Mm-hmm. So what I do, really, I'm old-fashioned, really, in a way, see? So what I do, I cater for the old people. So I know more or less what they like.
Famously, your appearance on Britain's Got Talent produced rather conflicting views. Piers Morgan said he thought you were so awful you should be beheaded.
Exactly, yes.
But I understand Simon Cowell, you know, was a little bit more kind-hearted towards
you. Yeah, I mean, he said we were so unusual, he was going to invite us to his birthday party, but we haven't been. I mean, this is it, you see. We're still waiting to go, really.
Yeah, so he might have been telling fibs.
Yeah, but we were on it twice, you know.
Yeah?
The first time we were on it, we went to Cardiff, to the Millennium Centre, see? And it was only me going to go on there, nothing to do with Thelma, the wife, right? So I'm in this queue about 50,000 altogether, going down there for audition, see? And I finally get to the front of the queue, and they said, "Who are you?" And I said, "I'm Don the Whistler." And I went like that to the wife, to wave to her, that is, you see? And they said, "Who's that?" I said, "She's called the wife." They said, "Get her over." So Thelma came over, mm-hmm. right? With that, they said to Thelma, news to me, they said, "What do you do?" And she said, "I'm a dancer." Well, I didn't know she was a dancer.
She suddenly produced a talent.
Yeah, she suddenly had a talent. She said, "Right, you're in." Okay. Next thing we know, we're doing this audition, see? And, about, I don't know, A couple of days later, we had a phone call and said, can you come back the following week to the Millennium Centre in Cardiff? And you're on in front of the judges. Because it's a bit fibs, really, what they do. I mean, they you know, when they say they don't know what you like, it's not true, because you've got to go through the auditions anyway.
Mm-hmm.
See? So we went through, and they said, no, what happened, what I said previously about, you know, they voted us off and Simon voted for us. But a couple of days later, though, we had another phone call from Simon's assistant to say, Simon thought it was a bit hard on you two. He said, can you come to the Shaftesbury Theatre in London on the West End?
Right.
She said, hang on a minute, I'll have to check my diary. I'm not sure, but I can come. Right, it's like I've come here tonight. See, I didn't know whether I could come, but I'm here. And we said, yeah, possibly we can come. So we went up there, and we must say that we were top of the bill. The only reason we were top of the bill is we were last on. You see, that was we were there at 11 o'clock in the morning,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's a crowded, great big room with all these different acts, all sort of acts there. Some done well, some didn't. And so we were the last on and the first off. But in, I forgot, what I did forgot to say about was when we were in Cardiff, the man that followed us on was Paul Potts, right?
Yeah.
And Paul Potts is the man that won the 100,000 quid. See, so
by Jove. But how did your wife react to Fama? And there were a few news stories.
Yeah, I know. She found it more difficult than me. Mm-hmm. I do like the publicity. You know, that's why I'm here tonight. And, you know, she took it harder than me. She had a job to get used to this sudden fame, see, because I've been doing it for a long time. But she did dance. When I say she didn't dance, she danced in our group. She would do. She would dress up as a cat, like from, you know, the musical Cats.
Yeah.
And what she would do, she would dance, and I would do the. I would whistle from Memories, you know, from the musical Memories. See,
yeah.
As she would do that, you see.
So, but she went missing. I understand.
Yeah. She unfortunately, Thelma did have a type of breakdown. And she went missing about, 3 weeks ago now. And she was missing, it was very serious at the time because she was missing for 6 days and we didn't know what had really happened to her at all.
So she didn't give you any indication, like, you know, that she might have, she was suddenly going to disappear? It was totally
unexpected to you? Well, no, that isn't quite true because she had done it, you know, twice before, but she'd only been out, say, for 2 days. And this time, I mean, the police were very worried and we had the helicopters and the... We had everything out, really, motorbikes, horses, anything.
But is she well? Is she okay now?
Well, she's not quite right now. No, she's having treatment now, but at least we know where she is. How it came about, though, was on our 40th wedding anniversary, last 25th of July, last year, I took her to the Isle of Wight. We went to Bournemouth, really, and went for the day to the Isle of Wight. On the way back, there was a lot of wash on the boat, and I got absolutely soaked. This happens to me because I do normal wisdom, and it really does. I'm not just acting; things do happen to me. So I went downstairs in the cabin, you know, in the dry. And Thelma is quite a stubborn woman. She said, "No, I'm all right, Don. You carry on." So, being the gentleman what I am, just before we came into Lymington, I went up the stairs and said, "Thelma, can I help you down the iron stairs?" Well, unfortunately, she said, no, I'm all right, Don. She slipped on the stairs and went down about 5 stairs and cracked her head.
Okay, so...
And that's what started it off, yes.
Right, okay.
Yeah, it's been quite serious, really, ever since.
How do you feel about having been on Britain's Got Talent? It's introduced a lot of drama, some good and some bad.
Yeah, it's a mixture, really.
Do you think it was a good idea to go on?
Oh, I think so. Well, overall, I mean, we've been on... I won't mention the programme, but it's... called the BBC, we've been on there quite a bit and what have you, and different people have rung us up. We were in the Daily Mail. They'd done a special thing on us on there. In fact, they thought we were going to do really well, you know, better than we did do. They thought we'd be down in the last half a dozen, you know. So
how do you feel about it in terms of, you know, your wife now? I mean,
well, I doubt very much whether she'd ever do it again, but I still carry on doing what we do, you know.
Okay, so you're still out whistling?
Oh yeah, nobody can stop me whistling. No, I'm terrible, really. I had actually given the wife tinnitus. I don't know, you know what tinnitus is in the ears.
The problem with hearing, yeah.
Yeah, with the urine, so she always blames me for that, see. But I get blamed for all sorts of things through this whistling, see. I do drive people mad on it, because I never really stop.
Does your entertainment group have a name?
Oh, yeah, we're called the Withywood Performing Arts.
The Withywood Performing
yeah,
Arts?
Yeah, it's rather
can
grand,
can we find
actually.
You online?
Pardon?
Can we find you online?
Yeah, you can do, yes. Yeah, we're on there. Can and be. Also on my website as well, see.
Oh, what's your website?
Yeah, it's Don the Whistler. Put Don the Whistler on, that we come.
Brilliant. Okay,
yeah, morning, so noon and night. There's 83,000 hits now.
Yeah, so if people want to book you, they can look you up online.
Oh, yeah, you can book us. We'll come along with any time.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Don the Whistler, thank you very much for coming
thank
on.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
And last but not least, after all that, let's hear a little bit more of Don the Whistler and his famous talent. Cathy Come Home, Kez and Land and Freedom are some of his most well-known films. Who am I talking about? At a packed public meeting in Eastern Community Centre a fortnight ago, award-winning director Ken Loach was particularly incensed by the media coverage of Israeli commando attack on May's Gaza Aid flotilla, in which Bristolians Cliff Hanley and Fishbombs kebab man Shakir Yildirim were caught up.
There is no objectivity. The news media see things through Israeli eyes, and it's done so subtly that we have to really spot the mechanism. It's who they interview, it's the questions they ask, and subconsciously, if you're not, you know, like people here, politically aware, subconsciously, the Palestinians are the terrorists, the Israelis are the soldiers. Of course, the other thing is the language. The Palestinians kidnap, the Israelis arrest, the Israelis detain. The Palestinians are activists, or gunmen, or worse still, terrorists. The Israelis are soldiers, you know, and we respect soldiers, and we don't respect gunmen. And it's the choice of language. And yet, of course, it is the Palestinians who are suffering from the breaches in international law. It's the Palestinians who are victims. I met a Palestinian human rights activist from Gaza, and he said, all we want is the rule of law. All we want is the rule of law. And I think it is our responsibility, and certainly our politicians' responsibility, that they won't discharge it. It is our responsibility to see that the rule of law applies in Gaza and in Israel. Tony Blair, of course, is always good for a laugh on these occasions. Speaking of the capture of the British sailors by the Iranians, he said, they, the Iranians, should not be under any doubt about how seriously we regard this act, which is unjustified and wrong. When he was asked about the flotilla and the nine murdered, he said, when it comes to security, I'm 100% on Israel's side. Israel has the right to inspect what goes into Gaza. This is Blair, or Blyer, as we like to remember him. And then, of course, there's the question of the independent inquiry. You can't have the rule of law without an independent judiciary. When was the last time we had murderers, their own judge and jury? Yes, that's what we've got with Israel's so-called independent inquiry. The irony of asking Trimble to be the independent observer, Trimble, the unionist, who opposed the setting up of the Savile inquiry, who was 100% behind Widgery, the Widgery investigation into the Bloody Sunday, which has now been thoroughly discredited. Trimble should be the independent judge of this so-called independent inquiry. I mean, is, well, as the Sun says, you couldn't make it up. But it does remind us of a very interesting triangle. Israel, hardline unionism, and South Africa. And there's a book just come out which called The Unspoken Alliance, Israel's Secret Relationship with South Africa. And it details the negotiations that went on between Israel and the apartheid state of South Africa for the supply of nuclear weapons. And there was no problem for the Israelis selling nuclear weapons to apartheid South Africa. They wanted to sell. They wanted the alliance. And there were, for various reasons, it didn't happen. But there was no shortage of intention to supply South Africa with nuclear weapons. And, of course, at one level it makes sense, because they're both states based on race. Race is at the heart of Israel's founding, of the right of return of Jews from whichever part of the world they're from, and no right of return for Palestinians, and, of course, apartheid South Africa based on race. And I was in Northern Ireland some years ago, and on the walls, on the Republican side, you would see victory to the ANC and the PLO. On the unionist walls, you would see Israeli slogans and the white South African slogans, the Brother Bond. And that was an unholy alliance of those three elements. And it's just an extraordinary piece of history. However, the last point I want to make is, we talk about the enforcing the rule of law, and the question is, how do we do it? Well, clearly we have to make demands on our politicians. Clearly we don't have to let it drop out of the headlines. But I think also I would look for a boycott of the State of Israel. There is already a boycott of a cultural, an academic boycott, which has been called for by Palestinian academics and which many of us support. And that is partly successful. It's fought bitterly by the Israelis, of course, who like to present themselves as civilized European-type country. I mean, why are they in the European football tournaments, for one thing? Why, God help us, are they in the Eurovision Song Contest? I mean, nobody should be in the Eurovision Song Contest, but certainly if it's a Europe-wide event. You know, what is this country that isn't in Europe doing? I mean, it is extraordinary how they've infiltrated their presence to be recognised as a democratic Western country like the rest of us, yet beyond international law, yet murdering with impunity, yet slaughtering thousands or over thousands in Gaza 18 months ago. So I hope that the big pro-Palestinian organisations will organise a thoroughgoing boycott of those events and goods supported by the State of Israel, not individual Israelis, of whom there are many, many who fight this issue much harder and under much more difficult conditions than someone like I do, who is in a very privileged position, but not those Israelis who absolutely have a sense of justice and are horrified at what their state is doing, nor of individual artists or filmmakers or writers who are independent of the state. But where the state is involved, then I think we should boycott it 100%. Anyway, again, what a brilliant thing this people on this flotilla did, and I congratulate them absolutely.
That was award-winning British film director Ken Loach there, talking recently to a packed meeting at the Eastern Community Centre.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Tony is from Weston-super-Mare, and this is the blind man that travels the world that we mentioned earlier on. Although he's severely disabled, he travels around and inspires others to do the same. Dialect's roving reporter Anthea Page met Tony Giles in a hostel in Plovdiv, which is in central Bulgaria.
My name's Tony Giles.
Where are you from?
Originally Weston-super-Mare in southwest England. Yeah, my website's www.tonythetraveller.com. I spent the last 13 years travelling around the world. I'm totally blind and 80% deaf. I travel by myself. My mum suggested I write a book about my exploits and escapades. So I started writing a book and I thought, well, if I'm going to publish, I better set up a website. So I spoke to someone who spoke to someone else who suggested someone who could set up a website for me. It was really simple to use for anyone who was blind or a bit old like me mum.
I mean, it's quite an inspiration. How have you managed to travel the world totally blind and with hearing disability as well?
You want to travel and confident. And if you're confident, you'll do anything. I had a desire to do things and travel from a young age. I got an older brother and an older sister. We both got no disabilities. When I was little, I wanted to be like them. And my dad traveled in the Navy when he was young and told me stories. And that gave me the desires to travel. I wanted to be independent. I wanted to be free.
Tell us how people react to you travelling when you've been across the world. Have they been kind? Have they been indifferent?
I was in a hostel in Bangkok, in Thailand. I met this guy from England. He started talking. I could tell you he was from Liverpool. I was taking the mickey out of his accent and stuff and talking about football. And he asked me who I was travelling with. I said, oh, I'm by myself. He couldn't believe it. He was absolutely astonished. He's gobsmacked. He said, you're by yourself? I said, yeah, I just want to travel and meet people. And I get around the world by communicating with people. I need a lot of help. I get a lot of help. And it's give and take. And people help me and it makes them feel good. Or they get something back. They get a different experience. They get to see the world how someone with no sight sees it.
What particular problems have you encountered that you've managed to overcome?
I've had things stolen. I was camping in Canada by myself. I had my tent and both my backpacks stolen. I was camping in a field and didn't have a lot of money left on me, and I needed to get some more medication. So luckily I'd met a guy travelling who was from Alaska, and I was close to Alaska at this point, so I just called him up on telephone and said, can I come and stay? It was no problem. In Sofia, in Bulgaria, I was in a church. I went to take some pictures for my website. I was in this church, St. Sophia, and this guy was showing me the way out. I thought he was a security. So I asked him to take a picture of me on the steps of the church. And took my camera, took a picture, and took me back inside the church. And before I could ask the camera back, he walked off with it.
Tell us how you manage with money, because that's one of the biggest issues when you're travelling, isn't it? Handing over money, checking the change.
Yeah.
How do you cope with that?
Yeah, money is a problem, and eating's a problem, and food's a problem. In England, the notes are different sizes, so it's not a big problem. And some countries, euros are also different sizes of the notes, so you can feel them and distinguish them. In somewhere like America or Canada, when the notes are all the same size and same colour as well, you've just got to count your money, you know, meet people in hostels and find someone you think you can trust and ask them. When I know what kind of money I've got, I tend to put the biggest notes on the bottom. So I put a 20 on the bottom and then a 10 and then a 5 and fold them. And when I was travelling around Africa 6 years ago, I had about 4 or 5 different currencies on me at one point. So I just put them in different places or fold them differently. But it's difficult. You've got to trust people to a certain extent. And being blind makes you trust people because you have to. You have to trust people to take you, you know, across the street or just to help you. Yeah, just go from A to B, really. So it's something you learn to do, at least on that first initial level, from a young age, being blind.
What's the biggest fear that you have when you're travelling?
I have my fears before I travel. The night before I travel, I panic at I can't do it and I won't be able to get to the places I want to go, or I'm getting too old and my skills aren't as good as they were. But as soon as I'm moving, as soon as I'm actually going, then yeah, the confidence just comes and I know I have complete faith in my ability to get from A to B. I was very lucky, had a good education and I had good mobility training. And I've always had complete faith that I'll be able to get from A to B and back again.
Well, thank you very much to our roving reporter, Anthony Page, on her travels around Eastern Europe there. And we heard Tony Giles. He talks about which countries have been most challenging to travel through. We hear more about that next week in the final part of the interview. And you can also read about Tony Giles and his book on his website, which is www.tonythetraveller.com. And that's all one word. Okay, if you remember last week, I spoke to Chanda, who's part of the Zimbabwean group Chimani Mani. We listened to a couple of tunes and he told us about life in Zimbabwe. Well, he's part of an arts project here in Bristol, Kongomana Arts. And it's all about sort of community cohesion and sharing cultures. And they have a lot of workshops featuring African dance and drumming, cookery. Chandra, tell us just a little bit about what's coming up with Kongomana Arts and you know, how people can get involved.
Yeah, there's I'm gonna do 6 projects around Bristol. So it's Fish Pond, 24th of July. There's a place called Crab Tree.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not quite sure whether it's Fish Pond or Eastern, but in between there.
Yeah.
And then there are others which are not yet confirmed, but it's St. Paul's, and I think South Mead.
Okay.
Yeah. There will be posters around anyway. If they look around for posters, we'll put them in pubs and libraries.
Are you on the internet or anything like
that? Yes, corner? Yeah.
Okay, do you know what the website address is at all?
Yeah, we use MySpace at the moment.
Yeah.
Which is www.myspace.com/chimanimani.
Okay, so that's, I'll spell that for you. Chimanimani. Chimani Money.
That's right.
And that's on MySpace, and you can look up on there to find out events and
yes,
what's going on.
Yes.
I understand you mentioned that there was a culture in Zimbabwe of giving thanks to your ancestors at the end of, you know, when you've done something.
Yeah.
And you said you wanted to share that with us now.
Yes, yeah. We believe that, you know, when you are given a chance like this, you know, I do appreciate guys. So I think it's not down to my wisdom. When I met Richard, it was by coincidence yesterday in the park. So I think it's my ancestors and his ancestors brought us together. So I need to give thanks to those ancestors I've been really going through hard time in this country with my status and things like that. But I'm meeting good friends. So I just want to sing a little bit for my ancestors. Okay. Mambo ebano abanduka iwe were ye mambo ebano abanduka iwe were ye mambo ebano mabanduka were ye kutonga kutonga rudziko nai baba iwe iwe kutonga makabata gano iwe were ye mambo ebano abanduka were ye were ye were ye mambo ebano abanduka. Thank you, my voice is gone, but I wanted to do you little.
So could you possibly give us a rough translation of what you've sung and what it means?
It's giving thanks to ancestors of the good things they are doing for me, because I don't believe it's down to my wisdom. It's some we Africans, we believe it's someone out there. It's like when your grandpa, grandma dies in your family, we don't say they are dead and forget about them, but we believe they're out there looking after the family. Whatever happens, good things for you, they are guiding you. Of course, it's part of you, it's your intelligence, education, whatever, but there's another force which is guiding you, so you got to give thanks.
Well, possibly there's some wisdom for the Western world out of that, definitely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Conspiracy theories, love them or hate them, most of us have an opinion one way or the other. Investigative journalist and historian David Southwell has been doing his best to get to the bottom of some of the world's most elaborate enigmas. In Secrets and Lies, he confirms the old saying that truth really can be stranger than fiction when you take the time to dig out the hard facts behind the smokescreen of rumours and disinformation. He doesn't pretend to have all the answers, but he has applied an investigative journalist's eye to riddles, modern and not so modern. And this week, we hear about drugs and medicines, courtesy of Malcolm Grieve.
Secrets and Lies, drip-fed by David Southwell. The discovery that you are being lied to and information is being kept from you always hurts more when those that you trust most are doing it. Our politicians and security services have proven so duplicitous, we are almost immune to the outrage that should naturally flow from exposure of their many falsehoods. We are in such a sorry state that those in the intelligence services who compile dodgy dossiers get promoted, while those politicians who use them to deceive us in order to start a war get re-elected, rather than booted out of office. However, there are many groups in our society that we generally still trust. One of them is the medical profession. This is natural. You have to have a degree of belief in those in whose hands you may have to place your life. The discovery that these gods in white coats have suppressed the truth and lied to us over the years as much as anyone else to protect their profession's reputation can come as a painful shock. If we cannot trust those who prescribe legal drugs to cure our ills to tell us the truth, it at least means that it is less of a surprise to discover that those leading the war against illegal drugs have plenty of hidden agendas and hushed up facts that the public would be horrified to uncover. Neither doctors nor the government drug czars seem willing to trust the public with full, open knowledge about the drugs taken for either medicinal or recreational purposes. A lot of things changed in America after 9/11. One of them was an incredible increase in the number of radiation detectors in use. It is now estimated that there are more than 12,000 in operation at airports, train stations, tunnels and bridges, along with the small portable scanners given to those working in roles such as Border Patrol. The introduction of the record number of detectors was not only to prevent Al-Qaeda smuggling and transporting radioactive materials, but also to allow the emergency services called to any terrorist bombing to know if a radioactive dirty bomb had been used. It quickly became apparent that there was going to be a problem. So many radioactive people were walking around that a ridiculously high number of false alarms was being triggered. Treatments from iodine therapy, used to treat thyroid cancer, to cardiac exams and CAT scans, were reported to be setting the alarms off. In Santa Fe, California, a full-scale alert was sounded, with the highway being shut down while a search for a nuclear device was carried out, purely because a man who had had a scan walked past a fire engine with its radiation monitor switched on. Radiation is measured in rems and millirems, and the monitor was set to detect 75 millirems, five times the naturally occurring radiation level. A spate of false alarms exposed the lack of information given to many people having medical scans. The benefits of a necessary scan outweigh the increased risk of cancer by exposure to radiation, but even so, some doctors are concerned that their colleagues order unnecessary CAT scans without telling the patients the full facts. None mention that a CAT scan gives a radiation dose of 1,300 millirems, the equivalent of being at a distance of 1.5 miles from the Hiroshima explosion. Surveys in America have shown that 7% of CAT scans are not needed, scans that cost patients up to $16 billion a year, and that 78% of doctors do not know the level of radiation involved in a scan. How can patients have informed choice when their doctors are so ignorant? We'll be right back.
Well, that was Malcolm Grieve. Thank you very much to him for reading another excellent extract from The People's Undercover Agent. Thank you very much to David Southall for letting us read his book, Secrets and Lies.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Eagle-eared listeners will know the name Trevor the Bard of Windmill Hill. He often comes in. We've got another poet in today, something a bit different. I'd like to introduce Tim Burrows. Hello.
Hi.
So, without further ado, try us out with a poem.
This is called The Moment. The moment waits disguised as a dream of yesterday. A peddler passes with a basket full of cares. A shadowy porter carries the baggage of the past in a battered suitcase. A stork flies overhead, dangling the crying form of the future. The casket of yesterday passes with a jazz band playing Mood Indigo. A key shifts sideways on a black and white pedestrian crossing. A blind beggar draws the final curtain with a burnt finger of charcoal.
And thank you very much. You've got an event coming up. Upstairs at the Nova Scotia pub, Saturday the 31st of July. Tell us what that's about.
Well, this is an idea because I do some music and I do some poetry. Diana Taylor comes along to the Lansdowne pubs, and she wanted to do some films of some poetry. Trevor comes to that sometimes. And my idea was, instead of doing poetry separately from the music, bring it together with a filmmaker, so have a celebration of Bristol's kind of maritime past.
Okay, so the event's called Shipshape and Bristol Fashion, Poems and Songs from the Sea. And it says a backdrop is to be painted live by the Rolf Harris of Coombe Dingle, Chris Beckett. And that's upstairs at the Nova Scotia, Saturday the 31st of July, about 8:30 in the evening. It says tickets £3 in advance, £4 on the door. Where can tickets be bought in advance? You know?
In advance from the various artists that are doing the show. So if you know David Johnson, I will give some to the landlord of the pub as well.
Okay, so how could people contact anybody who's involved?
If you go onto my website, then that can be found. It's on Facebook and it's also on MySpace.
Okay, so look up Tim Burrows.
Yeah,
that should get you. So tell us another poem to finish off.
This is a poem I wrote for John Cabot, or Giovanni Cabota, and I wrote it in the Nova Scotia. That's why the event's in the Nova Scotia. And that's why the landlord wants to have it there. The walls of this haven are covered with charts, paintings and photos, like old weathered marks. But no anchors drag in the harbour outside, no tall ship masts fill up the sky. Only one silent mariner gazes out to the sea, waits for the tall ships to return to the quay, bring sugar from Jamaica, rubber from Ceylon, tobacco from Virginia, silk from Hong Kong. Only water taxis and booze cruises disturb the still air as the Great Britain rests in her dry dock there, as the Matthews motor purrs on through the brine to the chatter of tourists dressed up so fine. Only one silent mariner gazes out to the sea, waits for the tall ships to return to the quay, bring sugar from Jamaica, rubber from Ceylon, tobacco from Virginia, silk from Hong Kong. This old port has lost its soul, so they say. Cabot won't return, he drowned far away. No tales of daring resound round tavern walls to the clinking of tankards and brawls in the hall. Only one silent mariner gazes out to the sea, waits for the tall ships to return to the quay, bring sugar from Jamaica, rubber from Ceylon, tobacco from Virginia, silk from Hong Kong.
Thank you very much, Tim Burrows.
Thank you.
And hopefully we'll have more of you in future weeks. Well, time for a man wearing a shirt that says Alcatraz Psycho Ward. He's braved having a dicky tummy to come all the way in and tell us what's going on this week. Jeff, what's going on?
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. starting with Wednesday, 14th of July, Easy Stars All Stars will be performing at the Thekla in Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £15 in advance. On Thursday, 15th of July, Spear of Destiny will be performing with support from Rita Lynch and also Petrol at the Fleece in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. Into Friday, 16th of July, Doreen will be performing at the Fiddlers in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £8 in advance. On to a song of the week, and I feature a group that includes Lemmy of Motorhead fame, Slim Jim Phantom of Stray Cats fame, and Danny B of Lonesome Spurs fame. This is from the album titled Lemmy, Slim Jim and Danny B, and it's a track titled Love's Made a Fool of You. That was Lemmy, Slim Jim and Danny B with the track Love's Made a Fool of You from the album Lemmy, Slim Jim and Danny B. Moving into Saturday, 17th of July, Terror Vision will be performing at the Fleece in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £15 in advance. On Sunday, 18th of July, Roots Prescription will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Bristol. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. Finally, on Tuesday, 20th of July, Public Image Limited will be performing at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £25 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you, Jeff. For those of you who remember an old Bristol group called the Blue Aeroplanes, some members of the Blue Aeroplanes have taken over the Fleece and Firkin. They're going to be running it soon, and apparently their policy is going to be no more tribute acts, so they're going to try and focus stuff on more local acts. Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM across Bristol at 12 noon every Sunday. If you're on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed, which will remind you every Friday when Dialect is online. You can download our podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. You can also find a low-bandwidth mono version of Dialect at bristol.indymedia.org every Friday morning. And you can also check out the Bristol Community FM website, bcfm.org.uk. Thank you very much to Julian Parry and Don Townsend for coming in. And the reporters this week were Tony Gosling and Anthea Page. Thank you also to Jeff Sparks for the What's On Guide. And the studio production was by Johnny Royden and Mike Reed. The producer was Tony Gosling. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and being cooperative, anyone can contribute. So if you're interested, get in contact through Volunteering Bristol, 0117 989 7733. Or you can look up bristolvolunteers.org.uk on the net and find out that way. That was Dialect, and I'm John Peters Cullen, wishing you a very good week, so enjoy the summer. Thank you very much. Goodbye.